right here on the Arms Room Show with Glenn
and Drew.
And we are thankful for all of our wonderful patrons. Thank you for continuing to support the show and allowing us to be able to do the things that we do in the community, some of our community service programs and Stop the Bleed classes, security training, and all that kind of stuff that we get to do for civic organizations and schools, et cetera, that we do thanks to the money that we get from Patreon. So if you guys didn't know that, we really appreciate your support. Also, of course, helps us keep the lights on and the show going. So thank you to all of our patrons. Remember, if you don't think you're getting all of your patron benefits, email us, info@trainingaz.com. If you're a new patron and you haven't gotten any of the swag, hit us up so we can make sure we send you out the stickers and all that good stuff. Oh, I think a big, exciting topic is something Drew and I did this past weekend. So we went up to one of our guys from Independence Training, Josh, is heavily involved in the precision shooting world and is involved with several organizations, including the National Rifle League or the NRL, and specifically the NRL Hunter Matches. And so he put on his very first NRL Hunter Match up at Gunside Academy in Paulden, Arizona. And Drew and I and one of our guys, Ben, and our friend Daryl, from Divergence Training, and then one of our very awesome students, Steven, all went there. And Friday, we shot all 18 stages in one day, which was a fucking lot of work. Yeah. And Drew and I shot as a team. Ben shot as an individual. And then the next 2 days, we spent ROing. And Drew and I and Ben and Daryl all RO'd. And then Steven was our role player for the assessment scenario that we also had at our shooting stage for a medical assessment. Friday night while we were there, we also taught a very short but very particular medical class about stopping the bleeding and good assessments and wound seals. And it was the very first time that the NRL Hunter has included stuff like this into their programs. And the feedback – so the results I was skeptical about. I thought, oh, man, these people are here to shoot a match. They're not really here to do this. But we designed these really cool med kits for the NRL Hunter series and these really badass lightweight kits. We're actually going to add to our website because they're so fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And I'm like super – it's like one of my favorite kits we've designed so far by a lot. But anyways, so we're kind of like, I don't know, we're kind of a little skeptical. It was amazing. Everybody, for the most part, was very receptive. The majority of people came through our stage, over 80 shooters, participated in the assessment. I'd say about half of people participated over at the Ben and Daryl stage putting on the tourniquet. And then we randomly drew – we drew two from the assessments and one from the tourniquet for someone to give one of our new NRL lightweight hunter kits to. So we ended up giving away some med kits, had a great time, and now I'm going to brag on Drew. All right, here we go.
Oh, gosh. Don't brag on me.
So – it was an amazing event. It was Drew's and Ben's, actually, very first rifle match. And so Drew and I shot it as a team, as I'd mentioned. Ben shot it as an individual. And we, with the ROs, were on the tail end of our squad. So we were the last shooters, mostly because I had to go take a shit. And when the order was getting laid out, I was like, I have to poop. I'll be back, boys. And when I got back, I was the last one. So there you go. But so we shot on the tail end, which means it was really just Drew and I and Ben kind of ROing each other. And I've got, you know, a few matches under my belt. And so I was able to help Drew and Ben. And here's what I saw. And I want to get your feedback, too, on this, Drew. This being their first type of match, every stage you had a basic, super, super basic stage description. I mean the most basic stage description. It was like one target, four positions, four target, one position, or a two target, two position. Those were the only options for stages.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would literally just show you a picture of what the target looked like. And then you would go up to the stage. You would run up to the stage. It was usually maybe a 20 to 50-meter run.
Yeah.
And you'd get up to the stage. You had flags that designated your left and right lateral limits and a flag that designated where you could definitely see all the targets from. And then you had to find, range, and engage all the targets. As a team, of course, that means both of us. Drew would shoot first. I would shoot second. And then, of course, as an individual, it means you had to do all the work by yourself. Having to show up in under time, individuals had 4 minutes, teams had 6 minutes, to show up and find everything was a whole new experience for Ben and Drew, having never shot these kind of matches before. And because they'd hide these targets. I mean, they'd be in the shadows. It'd be a brown target against a brown stump of a tree or, you know, whatever. So it was very – they did a very good job at hiding stuff. And there was also other targets out there that you wouldn't be engaging. So, you know, for example, let's say stage one was pigs. And they were little, like, javelina-style targets. Well, there was other targets out there, but you didn't engage them. So it had a lot to do with target identification, kind of like a hunter would have to do.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of work. And there were plenty of people, you know, shooters on day two and three, as we got to see all the other shooters come through that were, of course, people time out. Sometimes people would time out without ever even finding a target. Or they'd find one out of four or two out of four or something like that. We had a really good time. The first couple stages were a little rough trying to get – and it was just kind of a speed element, like here's the target. Now get on it, but you can't take so fucking long. Like you got to get on that target. You got to get your gun in position. You got to get on the target. It's efficiency of motion when you get to the stage and you try to accomplish as many things as you can as quickly as possible so that you have more shooting time.
Yeah.
And Drew and I did very well. Our very first team match and her very first rifle match, we came in 10th out of 18. So we were just excited.
That I got on the board.
We weren't last place. That's all that mattered. Drew did an amazing job. Both of us were shooting 6.5 Creedmoors. Both our rifles were built by LRK Mechanical. I was shooting my very lightweight Tika T3 Hunter, the super light, and Drew was shooting a custom build from LRK, built off a REM 700 chassis. And both of us shooting 6.5 Creed. Both of us shooting the same exact projectile, the Hornady 140 grain. OTM or BTHPs, and just a hell of a good time. I loved watching Drew make her own win calls, find the targets, engage them from some crazy ass positions, you know, propped off of rocks and logs and all kinds of stuff, and just absolutely killing it. Very last stage, we had to make about a 500-yard engagement, I think it was, or so, on that prairie dog popper.
Yeah, I think so.
And just a little prey dog, like 500 yards.
There's
and
two
we,
of them.
We had a solid crosswind going on right then. I think I was holding the half mil to get it at that distance, so I can't remember what that was. But I would say it was a solid, you know, 12-mile-an-hour wind. And Drew freaking nailed that prairie dog first time. Just really did a great job. Had a great example of, you know, 18 stages in one day for someone's very first rifle match is a fucking lot of work. And she got through it all. And then over the next 2 days, when I was ROing the stage, when a shooter was done, Drew would grab him and give him the quote-unquote optional, which Drew made less than optional sometimes, kind of just made people do it, but do an optional med assessment where our great student, Steven, who's super helpful for us and lots of fun to be around, was able to, you know, play the part of a wounded person. And they would have to do a full assessment on them and then say or even write down what they would do. And then based on that, we put their name on a list, and that's what we randomly drew from. And Drew did an amazing job teaching a lot of people how to do assessments and also fine-tuning some people's assessments. There's a lot of very knowledgeable people there, some guys who were, you know, TCCC and CLS trained, and paramedics were there and all kinds of stuff. And they even learned some things from Drew. So it was really awesome to watch that whole experience. And then Drew got to experience something even more important, which was the continuation of the sport. There are, you know, a couple of things that are pretty near and dear to our hearts, and that one when it comes to the shooting world. One is new shooters who are just trying to get into it. And it's difficult because it's cost prohibitive and it's expensive for a lot of people, especially in a precision rifle. There's nothing cheap in this world. Fucking rear bag is, you know, $150. Like, nothing is inexpensive. And also young shooters. And the last shooters to come through our section were a father and son. They weren't shooting as teams. They were shooting as an individual. And then their uncle, or the boy's uncle, was there hanging around and watching. And they had all made a big family trip down here from the state they live in. And, you know, while the men were out shooting this thing, you know, everyone else was out at a gallivant around town or whatever. And the dad was this guy who's like, man, I grew up in Chicago. I wasn't really into shooting until my two sons started getting me into shooting through the 4-H, you know, shooting club. Mm-hmm. and now we're doing stuff like this, and this is our first match, and it's very expensive for me to do all this, you know. And he's like, God, I'm buying rifles for everybody and spotting scopes. He's like, ugh, it's cost prohibitive. So he's just kind of telling, he wasn't complaining. We were just conversing because they were our last shooters. And so when we were done on day two, we're just kind of shooting shit with them. And I was really happy to see this father and son shooting. There was a couple other fathers and sons, but this one was just really, really warming my heart and how they interacted with each other. Very positive. And then Drew went through like fucking like 30 or 40 minutes worth of medical shit with them while I was cleaning up and just did a great job. So we get to the end where it's time to do awards and all that. And because, of course, we had competed, you know, we get to go walk the prize table appropriate to our placing with the teams. And it's hard for us off a prize table. It's always been kind of hard for me because there's a lot of stuff on there like I've already got. I'm not being a dick about it. It's just I've already got a lot of the stuff. I work in the industry, so it's easier for me to have most of the stuff that's available. And so a lot of times I'll take, you know, I've taken, you know, $30 items because I'm like, oh, shit, I need one of those. You know, and people are like, dude, you were, you know, fourth place, and that's what you took. You could have taken a whole rifle. I'm like, but I don't want another fucking rifle. Mm. Yeah, but you could have taken it and sold it. What a dickhead thing to do. There's someone out here who needs that shit. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. No. And I know some competitors do that, and that's how they pay for their opportunity to go to matches and stuff. They do well, and then they take something off the prize table, and they sell it or whatever. That, to me, is not why the donors, and as a sponsor of events, that's not why I don't donate med kits to this event so someone can sell the med kit and make enough money to pay for their trip. I mean, it's theirs. They can do whatever they want with it, but that's not why I donate it, you know? Mm-hmm. So I've never been about that life. So we're looking at some stuff up on the table, and there wasn't really a whole lot of anything that Drew and I were like, oh, God, we really need that because we kind of have all this stuff, you know? But there was a great cert from a steel target company. I got to get some more steel targets. So I'm like, I'll take that. You know, I can put that to good use. And we don't really know what else to get. You know, we're a team, so we get two. So then Drew gets it in her mind. Well, what if we take care of one of the younger shooters? So we take a Vortex, a very nice, a very big Vortex Optics gift certificate off the table, and very low key, very much not in everyone's eyeballs, and in my opinion, the way it ought to be done, not out in the open, hey, everybody, look what I'm doing. We go sit down, and then Drew kind of quietly goes over this young shooter and gave him the cert. It was an incredibly emotional experience for that young man. He just couldn't stop hugging Drew and was so excited, and of course, his dad was excited because now he didn't have to spend more money on something. And it was awesome. And that was something that made me even more proud of all of Drew's accomplishments this last weekend. Was she just really kicked ass all weekend long. You know, it was fucking cold in the morning. Drew is not a cold weather person. Mm-hmm. And we averaged 15 to 20 degrees in the morning. It was cold as hell. And it was cold for several hours until it, you know, finally started to warm up. And even then he still had a coat on. It was still relatively chilly. And, you know, we shot those 18 stages. We didn't sleep a lot at night because we were out with people or, you know, whatever. So there was like minimal sleep, cold weather, lots of work, doing all the shooting, doing all the med assessments. Just really made me proud of Drew. And I wanted to share that with you guys because it was an awesome thing to experience with your partner. And then kind of the little cream on top was when she, you know, gave that cert to that young shooter because it really meant a lot to him. It meant a lot to that young man. And then another shooter gave him his walk of the table.
Yeah.
And he ended up, his dad was kind of cool because his dad was telling me while we were shooting with them, oh, yeah, man, we really need another tripod. But, of course, these nice tripods are freaking expensive. And what's on the table? But one of my favorite tripods, the Vortex Radian. And so they were able to pick one of those up from the prize table as well. From another shooter who's a very well-known guy and a great shooter and a very humble shooter and was like, hey, you know, again, what the fuck do I need up here? Nothing. Who can I give it to? And so he gave it to this young man as well. And so, you know, those guys walked out of there with a very positive experience and a lot of new knowledge and a lot of fun with each other. And that was just, it was a very cool experience, you know, and I was very, very proud of Drew for the whole weekend. It was awesome. What were your takeaways from the event?
It was really cold.
Yeah, it was very cold.
Well, besides that, I mean, overall, it was a really good time. It was a good time ROing. It was a good learning experience for me. Just the only other time I've ever really shot a long gun like that is our precision rifle class, which I've taken twice now. And I think it's been a year since we had our last class that we took. So You know, biggest things for me was obviously just getting on the spotter and looking for targets was a pain in the ass for me.
Until you know what to look for. Yeah. Because there was a couple stages where I walked up, like, there's a target right there. And she's like, how do you know that? I'm like, because I've done 50 of these matches.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I know where they're going to put them.
Well, yeah. It's
look in the shittiest fucking spot. Start there. Don't look in the nice spot. Look in the shitty spot. Yeah. Start there. That's probably where you're going to start finding targets.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was, like, one of my big things was taking away was really that aspect of just finding your targets and ranging them and trying to slow your breath down, because when you're trying to range targets and you're just run, it's really hard.
Yeah, run up to a position, find a target, get on your rifle and start trying to shoot. You haven't even caught your breath yet.
Yeah, which I think obviously was the idea of the whole entire match.
And you're not from the prone either, you know, you're
propped
up on a tree limb or something.
Yeah, there were a lot of stages where you had to shoot off the trees. There were quite a few of those stages. So a lot of it, too, is just building good platform, which I feel like I did pretty well. I could have improved on some of mine. If I would have taken my time and actually just looked at the terrain more, I probably could have been prone a lot more.
Mm.
So, but just kind of taking your time. But also, at 6 minutes, when you and your partner both still have to do everything, taking your time isn't really something that you have.
I think that was my biggest takeaway, too, is just how much more time I need to practice with my positions. You know, I pulled off some good impacts from some really shitty positions, but there were definitely some shots that I missed that would have easily been improved with an extra 5 seconds of building my position. And yeah, it's a compressed time frame, but, you know, it's do I take 5 seconds to build this position and then fucking fight it for 10 seconds before I can take the shot? Or do I take 10 seconds to build this position and then be able to make the shot, you know? So a lot of it was just, it's been a little while since I've shot a rifle match. And so it was just kind of me forgetting some really easy shit that I already know. And I'd look back after this stage and go like, no, I totally should not have done that, you know? But that was fun. It was a great time. I can never recommend these matches enough to people. The NRL matches generally, they have NRL, the NRL 22, and the NRL Hunter matches. They're all over the country. I highly recommend them. At that level of playing field, even for brand new shooters, it's expensive to play this game, and people travel all over the place to come to these matches. The douchebag level is so insanely low as to be non-existent. I mean, I didn't have one jerk shooter on the stage. I RO'd every single shooter through the stages.
Yeah.
I never had someone who was a jerk.
And everyone was really thankful. Everyone thanked us for ROing.
It's like, so it's just a very different, you know, experience. Yeah. But anyways, we could keep going on, but we really enjoyed the match. The only thing of note in the news I thought that was interesting was the Texas synagogue hostage situation. And there's two things that were interesting. The rabbi, Charlie Citron Walker, said the training he got from police and the FBI kicked in toward the end of the terrifying 10-hour standoff at his congregation, Beth Israel, in Coleyville, Texas. What he did was take a chair and threw it at the terrorist dude so that they could get the hell out of there. Now, here's the interesting thing, and this is my second point. So first point I want to say is violence is awesome. This rabbi saved the lives of at least these three people. He did a phenomenal job. Very, very awesome that he did that. The second thing was this I'm reading from right now is the New York Post. And they call, without naming who, because they're talking right now about the rabbi, not the bad guy. They call the bad guy a terrorist, right? All right, I'm reading through the rest of it. They call him a terrorist a couple of times here. Now, in other news, like the BBC, for example, that I'm reading, they're specifically talking about how the hostage taker was British. British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss described it as an act of terrorism and anti-Semitism, adding, "We stand with U.S. in defending the rights and freedoms of our citizens against those who spread hate." Are you ready for his name? Malik Fasil Akram. Give me a fucking break with this British shit. Unreal. Really? That you're going to go that he's British? You're going to go with he's British? I'm sure he's a British citizen, but that's what we're going to do? In a synagogue? What do you think he was there for? He apologized. His brother apologized to the victims and saying he was suffering from a lot of mental health issues. Blah, 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 blah. The whole story, there's tons more information and details of the story I don't have time to get into. But my point is, once again, the news is insane. Because when they're talking to the rabbi fighting the guy, they call him a terrorist several times, even in the New York Post. But then you look at the BBC and they're going, oh, yeah, let's focus on the fact that he's British. Okay. Whatever. Other than that, the news is what it is. People are still doing the shit that they're doing. I can't think of anything that's really noteworthy. I was working so fucking much last week. I barely had time to pay attention, so I have no idea what else is going on in the news. So we're going to get right to our Redwire gear moment, and that is working gear in all weather conditions. That was a big takeaway from the match this weekend was when it was 15 degrees, people would show up on stage, it's cold, and now they've got to work their gun, they've got to get in position, they've got to do all the gloves on, or do they take their gloves off? You know, that was a question I watched a lot of shooters kind of having to make in their head. And it's just working with your gear in all weather conditions that are realistic to you. I mean, we talk about it in the heat here. This weekend it was a cold, certainly, but in the middle of the summertime here in Phoenix where it's, you know, 115 degrees and your palms are sweaty and gear gets slippery and all that, working with your equipment in all weather conditions, you know, picking something up when it's scalding hot in the summertime or picking something when it's freezing cold in the wintertime are going to affect how you're going to be able to use or manipulate that piece of equipment. Do I get gloves? Now is the time before you need them to find the right kind of gloves. Gloves that are thin enough for you to be able to feel the piece of equipment, but thick enough to protect you from either that scalding heat or that freezing cold. So just practice with your gear in all weather conditions, whether that's guns, whether it's tools, whether it's medical, whatever it may be. Redwire Gear Moment brought to you by redwiregear.com. Okay, our topic for the day, which admittedly is going to be kind of short, mostly just because we have a slightly compressed time frame for today. We've got a bunch of shit going on right now, but and also because there's not really too much to this topic, but it's something that we haven't talked about for a long time. And as I was going back through some of our show notes, it was something I realized, man, this is something I think bears talking about. And that is buying guns as an investment and building a well-rounded collection. Now, I want to start with the second part of building a well-rounded collection, right? Consider that most guns are collectibles to most people. If you only bought guns as usable tools, then what do you really need? A rifle, a shotgun, and a pistol. Maybe you also consider a rifle and a carbine and a shotgun and a pistol. And that's it. If you have those four guns, something, a rifle to stretch way out, to hunt big game, things like that, a carbine to do, you know, real world Save America stuff, to, you know, a shotgun because you should have a shotgun, and then a pistol. That's it. If you were buying guns just to be functional, those would be the four guns I would recommend everybody have.
Yeah.
And on that shotgun, though, here was something interesting I saw at the Hunter match this weekend. It's a Hunter match, the idea of it being hunting related. But, of course, most people, not everybody there was a hunter. Some people were. But on our stage, we had a prop gun. The first round you had to shoot was at a coyote target relatively close from a 12-gauge pump-action shotgun. And it amazed me, honestly amazed me, how many people didn't know how to properly work that shotgun. I mean, I had to walk them through it.
Yeah, eventually it just became part of your speech when they first, when you're directing them to where our stage was at.
Because it was too many people who were just like, I don't know how to do this. What the? And it's like, dude, that's a pump action shotgun. Like, that's not even hard.
You don't shoot them. I couldn't do it.
And a lot of people get away from that because, you know, growing up, we all shot shotguns. It's the most common gun you had, but now they're not as common. Now, an AR-15, certainly, or someone can pick up and operate that potentially, but or a semi-automatic pistol, but a shotgun, not as much. So, my point is a well-rounded collection still ought to include a shotgun.
Yeah.
That well-rounded collection, and I'm going to start with the collection of just necessities first, those four necessities, should also be in well-known calibers and easy calibers, meaning your rifle should be a 308 Winchester or maybe a 30-06 Springfield, something that's common, something you're going to find even maybe surplus ammo for. Your shotgun should be 12-gauge. Your carbine should be 5.56, and your pistol should be 9mm. Those are NATO calibers. Those are common calibers. those are kinds of things I can go into mom and pop gun shops and buy ammo off the shelf for. Then people say, well, hold on a second. 308 Winchester's not a great hunting round. It's not. 6.5 Creedmoor, 270 Winchester, 243 Winchester, 260, or I don't care. Pick one. They're all good. There's so many good options out there. But now you're talking about building a collection. Now you're not just talking about the most functional stuff. Because maybe you're, you know, I grew up with a lot of guys, you know, rolling their own rounds in their garage for their, you know, 7mm 08 Ackley improved kind of thing. And that's really cool. But you're not going to walk into a store and buy ammo for that. And so now you're talking about having a collection, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes people will – and I want to segment here for a second and say I also consider a good 22 long rifle or rimfire to be a very important part of the collection. But I have different reasons than most people think. They're like, yeah, that way you know you can use something to hunt small game. It's like, dude, I can hunt small game with the other guns as well. But – that's not why I want a lot of 22s. 22s, in my opinion, the reason I want 22s is because they're inexpensive and cheap to shoot and practice with. So now I can practice my marksmanship. I can practice my tactics. I can teach my kids. I can teach other people, whatever it may be, with this tool that's incredibly inexpensive and easy to practice with. It's not so that I can take small game in the apocalypse because, I mean, how much fucking small game is running around Chandler?
Yeah, none.
I want you to eat all the cats. What's left? When we got a couple rabbits maybe. It was like the whole, oh, I'll go to the woods and hunt. Yeah, you and 50,000 other people. There's people who go small game hunting right now and come back empty-handed, and there's not 50,000 people in the woods with them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not caring about taking of small game. I care more about the training and practice elements of it. But if you were going to cut something out, I would cut out those guns. I am a 22 nerd. I love 22s. I will buy a 22 at a gun store if I see it just because it may have cool collectible value. To me, I like 22s. We have a ton of 22 guns because I enjoy shooting them and having them, and they're fun. And we go out with different ones, and it's just fun to shoot them. But they're unreliable. They are going to have problems. They have misfires. The ammo and the guns are dirty. The ammo is inexpensive. It's not very powerful. And someone somewhere is going, yeah, well, back in Vietnam, they used to use a ton of rats at 22. Let me just stop you right there. I know that. I know the history of 22s. I know you can kill a man with a 22. I know all that stuff. But I'm saying they're the least likely to accomplish that on a big scale. You know, yeah, my dad's got stories of, you know, guys killing moose with 22s. Yes, it happens. But it's not consistent, and you certainly wouldn't go moose hunting with a 22.
Yeah.
Right. So my point is, if I was going to cut anything from the table, it would be those, just because it is they're more maintenance, they're less reliable, and they're not very powerful. So that being said, all right, and this is coming from me, who absolutely loves 22s. So a collection now starts to be why you have different hunting rifles for different things. Okay, now you're a collector. Well, I have different carbines for different things. Well, now you're a collector. I have different shotguns or different pistols. Now you're a collector because ultimately you don't need all of those tools. You just need one. It's like I understand there's different hammers. There's several different types of hammers. But a hammer is still a hammer. There's different types of hammers that are better at certain types of jobs. But if I need to drive a nail, I can pick up any hammer and drive that nail. I don't need to have all five or six or whatever different types of hammers. I'm sure there's more than that. It's the same thing with guns. I really only need those four. Good pistol, good shotgun, good carbine, and good rifle. And if you wanted to combine carbine and rifle, you kind of could. You know, if you really wanted to trim it down. Anything past that is now collection. Now, there's nothing wrong with collecting guns. Just be realistic about why you're doing it. Are you collecting guns because they are collectibles? Meaning they have value to me because I like that this gun was used in this engagement, or people who build clones of guns so that it looks like something that was used by a certain organization or a certain unit or during a certain time period or anything like that. Or are you collecting them for potential investment value? Now, I'll say this. We actually just came back from lunch with a very good friend of mine who is absolutely a gun collector. And we were talking a lot about values of guns, and he's a nerd when it comes to this stuff. He's like, but then this part's kit and that part's kit, and you could take this, and boy, you could buy this thing for $400, and then you could sell it for $800 because on this website it's like this. And he's got all this information about guns and collections as investment. I know what he's talking about with all the stuff, but I don't know what all those values are.
Yeah.
I'm not that kind of a gun nerd where I'm into listening or looking up and researching and web checking and getting on forums and discussing and all that, all these different things. Because he's going, oh, yeah, I built this, you know, crazy gun and now, you know, I've got $4,500 in it. And then, you know, I sold it for, you know, $8,000 because, you know, it was this market and then they stopped importing this. And then I knew that was going to happen. So I got in on this. And it's like any other type of investment and trade. You've really got to pay attention to what's going on in that market. Otherwise, you're just kind of blindly buying. So there's a lot of that goes into it that I think has to be considered. You got to kind of be a gun nerd. And I don't think most people are into it that much where they know about all these little obscure things that are now worth a lot of money, you know?
Yeah.
So if you want to get into that level of investing in guns because you know they're going to be worth a lot of money later, then that's – you got to get more nerdy about it. I don't do that. I look at guns as investments because I know that they're never going to go down in value. Not really. If they do go down in value, then that's probably a really horrible time in our country. I have never bought a gun that I lost money on if I had to sell it. Sometimes I'm like every other human being. Sometimes get some hard up times, right? I've sold some of my guns to make money so that I could pay a bill or, you know, pay for something for the kids or whatever it is. And still I've never lost money in that. I've sold guns during panics to people who were freaking out. Great. I had bought and built a couple of extra ARs during the good times so that when it panicked again, I had a couple of just burner guns basically sitting around. You know, this last crazy panic that was, I had a couple of clients who really, really wanted ARs and, you know, it's a legal private party transaction and they couldn't get anything less for, you know, than $2,000, $25,000, $3,000. It was crazy what some guns were going for. And I had some guns that I had parted together and built for, you know, $600. And they came to me and said, I'll give you $1,500 for any AR that you have. And it's like, okay, that's a good ROI for me. I'll happily sell that. Same thing with mags, same thing with ammo, all that stuff. I typically don't, but if someone really comes to me and they're hard up for something, hey, man, I really need it. It's like, okay. Yeah, we'll sell you 9mm ammo for this class. It's going to be, you know, 95 cents a round because that's what it would cost us to potentially replace it. But yeah, and it doesn't matter that we only paid 17 cents a round for it. That's what it is. So I've never really lost money on guns or anything like that. Outside of accessories like optics and lights and stuff, those things don't retain their value because that's a bolt-on accessory thing. That has nothing to do with the gun itself, not really. So those types of things, unless you're dealing with very, very specific limited edition collectible type optics that they don't make anymore, you know, something from World War II or something like that, that's a little bit different. But I'm talking about modern stuff. Yeah, those things don't retain their value. Optics, lights, grips, aftermarket stuff, they don't. NFA items retain their value. Suppressors, things like that. Things, you know, there's a certain scarcity that creates a value increase. Like, you know, pre-86 fully automatic firearms. Well, when that ban happened and no more guns, no more full auto guns were being made like that. And if you're a non, you know, regular person just doing a trust or, you know, a personal transfer and you're not like an 07 manufacturer and you want to go get a, you know, an M16 or an M60 or something like that, it's all going to be pre-86. Well, guess what? There's only so many of them. And so it's going to cost you a shitload of money to get that. Now, those guns are still investments. So if you had the money and you went and bought one of those very overpriced full auto guns right now, what's going to happen to the price? It's just going to go up because as time goes on, there's going to be less and less and less of those things around. People are holding on to them. Maybe some of them get destroyed, lost, whatever, right? I don't mean lost like someone lost them, but lost as in, you know, they get whatever, destroyed or whatever it may be. So there's going to be less and less and less supply. Those values are just going to continue to go up. Guns as an investment also has a lower barrier to entry than most investment opportunities you may find. You can go start buying, you know, pistols and carbines for pretty little amount of money and just sit on them. But the trick with guns as an investment is you got to be willing to sit on them. And then when the time is right to sell them, you have to be paying attention, one. And two, you can't have any emotional attachment to these guns. I see people who get like emotionally attached to their guns or like a part of their identity or something. And it's like, yeah, we'll fucking sell just about any gun I own. I'm not that emotionally attached. There's a couple of heirloom guns I wouldn't want to sell. There's a couple of personal guns that I trust and I really like using that I wouldn't want to sell. But there's tons of guns that I would happily get rid of because I don't have any emotional attachment to these things. You know, they're just metal and wood or metal and plastic or whatever, and they have a certain value, and that's it. If I need to get rid of them, I'd get rid of them. I'm not emotionally attached to them. So I think it kind of just depends on how you look at what kind of investment you're going to make. You know, I like to buy guns for the kids early on in their lives so that by the time they get old enough to shoot them, we just already have the gun. And knowing that prices are going to increase in the future, no worries. We've got little 22s for kids, and we've got bigger guns for kids, and even bigger guns for kids, and on we go. So we've got all the things that we need. And if we sit on them, all that's going to happen is those guns are going to be worth more money in the future. And if in 20 or 30 years I give them to them or whatever it may be, and they go, yeah, cool, awesome, Dad, thanks. And then they get on hard times and they got to sell it or something, it would suck, right? But like, cool, they're going to make more money than we paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the value of the dollar, of course, has a big impact on whether or not, okay, something bought 20 years ago for $500 and sold, you know, today for $1,500, well, it really may not actually be worth more. But so maybe you're only really getting your money back out of it just because of depreciation and inflation, all that kind of stuff. But in the end, it's still something you didn't lose money on. It's tough to look at this as an investment. I mean, I always say, kind of joking with people, that I invest in precious metals, you know, ammo and guns. They're always something that are going to be needed. And especially if it gets to the point in this country where it may inevitably go to, there's going to be a lot more people that are going to want guns. If you happen to be sitting on a few extras, that's going to be worth a lot. I mean, think back to the Oregon Trail days of, you know, that little, even that little video game, right? Where it's like, yeah, when you needed bullets and guns or whatever to shoot the buffalo so your family didn't starve, guess what you were willing to give for it? Just about fucking anything. Because you needed those bullets or whatever, mm-hmm. You know? So I think that a lot of it's just looking at what the real value of the gun is now and what it's going to be in the future, and also looking at making sure that you have your own kind of personal, I'll call it a collection, but it's really like a, maybe an arsenal is the better word, or you know, your toolbox of very specific guns of like, these are the guns I won't get rid of, you know? Like, I have a carbine, Drew has a carbine. These are guns we're never going to get rid of. I have a long-range rifle, Drew has a long-range rifle. These are guns we're never going to get rid of. You know, I have a shotgun. Drew definitely doesn't have a shotgun because she hates them. But
nor will I ever have one.
But I have a shotgun.
I would get rid of it.
That I would never get rid of. You know what I mean? I've got a pistol. Drew has a pistol that we would never get rid of. We might change it later. I'm not saying this particular gun I'll never get rid of. I mean, I'll never not have a good 9mm handgun.
Yeah.
You know, I've changed 9mm. My personal carry guns have changed over the years. I'm not emotionally attached to any of them. But I'm always going to have a 9mm handgun.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's really, you know, what people want to look at. Like, yeah, 357 SIG or a 10mm or whatever, a badass. But ultimately, that 9mm is always going to be available. And if some other caliber suddenly pops up in the future and becomes way more available, then I'll start recommending that. But I want the commonly available rounds, NATO-type rounds, stuff my local law enforcement uses, the stuff I'm likely to be able to, you know, scoop up from local military units or whatever. Shouldn't be able to pick up off the ground, basically. Or just walk into any mom-and-pop store and buy.
Mm-hmm.
That's the stuff that I want. So and you got any input on that, Drew? Any points on buying guns as investments or building a collection?
I mean, it's just like with any type of investment or any type of collection that people utilize, you know, there's always going to be an ebb and flow when it comes to what's going to be rare, what's going to be worth something. Sometimes things are worth more, sometimes they're worth less. But I mean, if you can retain it and hold on to it and capitalize on it, and if you don't have to liquidate your assets to have quick cash, you know, there's that term cash is king, but the way that it seems like things are going nowadays, cash might not even be around. Cash is, you know, pretty much going away. And it's one of those things that it's guns and ammo are going to be top prized possessions besides water and food.
Mm.
You know, their behavior modifiers, they're just something that is probably going to be more necessary than we would prefer in the upcoming years, maybe, depending on how everything goes. And, you know, it's just one of those things that if you can retain him and hold on to him, I would retain him and hold on to him for as long as you can.
You want to think about how you're going to protect these things too. Like,
yeah.
You know, think about, okay, if you have some kind of collection or you have firearms that you want to keep.
Don't show it off. Don't brag about it. Don't post it on social media.
Be careful
media.
About who knows about it.
Yep. Because you'll be first target.
Be careful about how you store them. You mm-hmm. want to make sure you store them safely, securely, not just laying around the house. And also consider getting, you know, look at your insurance. Look at your homeowner's insurance. You may have a limitation. You know, I've had an insurance policy before that I didn't know had a limitation until I looked it up and found out it had a limitation. And then I had to get a rider for it so that I could, you know, actually have that extra coverage for the firearms that I owned. Consider, in addition to that, you know, how are you going to protect the guns from civil liability issues? So, like, guns that I absolutely positively, in addition to NFA stuff, guns that I absolutely positively am never going to get rid of, heirlooms and stuff like that, all go on a trust.
Yep.
So that way I don't technically own them. The trust owns them.
Yeah.
And so now they are protected to an extent from, you know, civil problems or, you know, other types of
confiscation. Yeah, because you never know.
Confiscation.
Some of these guns could be outlawed pretty soon. You know, ARs could be gone, AKs gone, anything that's super scary could be banned. I don't think it would happen, but it's a possibility.
We look at personal ownership compared to, you know, company ownership or trust ownership. Yeah. I don't know how that would all, you know, boil down in the law, but it's just for me, it's mostly just protecting. Like if I get sued by somebody,
yeah, they can't, you know, take them.
They can't come after certain things because they're protected.
Yeah.
You know, so think about how you're going to protect those as well. And that's an important thing to consider.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's about all I have to say about it. Like I said, it's going to be kind of a short topic, but I mean, there's not really a whole lot else I've got to say.
Yeah.
If you're listening and you think we really missed something on this, please email us, info@trainingaz.com, and let us know, hey, you know, don't forget about this, or have you ever considered this, or whatever. That way we can share that information with other listeners. And I've gotten several emails. I've been really busy, so I haven't read all of them, but we've gotten several emails from our listeners about the thing I kind of called you guys out on last week of like, hey, just fucking do it. Send us your thoughts on what you like about the show and what you want to improve about the show or whatever. And several people did it, and I really appreciate you guys doing it. Don't worry. I'm going to get to those, and I'll make sure I respond to you and also incorporate that information into probably next week's show as well. So remember, you can bring us out to train with you. Get hosting information via email, info@trainingaz.com. We'll give you all the info about how to get us out and into your area. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram as The Arms Room, Independence Training, Red Wire Gear, and MRC Phoenix. Don't forget, tonight, every Monday night, is the MRC Phoenix run at the Chupacabra Tap Room in Mesa, Arizona at 6 p.m. The Independence Training moment for this week kind of ties into what the Red Wire Gear moment and my initial opening statements had to tie into, and that was the rifle match. What did Drew and Glenn do this past week to better prepare the four zones for an emergency? It was teamwork and communication. You know, those first couple stages were kind of rough. I have a very specific way I communicate, you know, target location with the other two shooting partners I have for these types of competitions that Drew just wasn't understanding. And some of the I realized that the way I was describing geographical features to Drew wasn't working because she didn't know the kind of geographical features I was describing. And so that opened up my eyes to, guess what? Drew and I need to go out into the wilds, and I need to describe stuff to her, you know? And then she needs to describe stuff to me. Because there was a couple very funny times where I'm like, okay, Drew, can you get me on this target? And she's like, it's right up there next to those two trees. And I'm like, You've got to be fucking kidding me. There's literally 5,000 juniper trees out there.
But they are the two that are separate
those
by
two,
themselves.
Look at those two that are right there. I'm like, there's the 10 bunches of two trees. Oh. Be more specific. It's over there right in front of you. And it's like, oh, you've got to give me more. You've got to give me, like, based on geographical features. Where's it at from the wash? Yeah, where's it at from other targets? Where's it at from our position?
He was pretty frustrated with
me. Where's it at from this, right? So there was a couple times where it's like, I literally have no idea what you're looking at. That really started to fine-tune itself as we got more and more just time doing it. Just more time communicating with each other. Yeah, the first three stages, pretty rough. After that, by the end stage, man, I was barely calling out the target location and Drew was already like, I'm on it. You know, it's like, okay, well, I'll find that one. Yeah, I'm on it. What about this other target? I'm on it. There's a lot of great capabilities there that just took time to develop. So teamwork and communication with both of us, definitely something we're going to practice, more shooter spotter communication on unknown targets and just geographical features and things like that. Like, hey, I'm spotting a rock right now. It's, you know, I want you to see this type of rock in this kind of location kind of stuff. So yeah, that was definitely a big thing that we, I think, did to prepare this last week, was just work a lot on our teamwork and communication. And just, you know, making sure the other person was set up for success. There was, you know, a couple times where I could have helped Drew better or she could have helped me better just in making the shot, where it would be like, hey, get me this or get me that. And it just wasn't quite, you know, flowing well. By the time we got to the end, it was much better. So just keeping working on that. We're proud members of the Heroes Media Group. Take a look at the other things that that network has to offer. So many great services that they have. Next week, we are going to be going over the contents and the purpose, the realistic purpose, of a good EDC or get-home bag. What would we really absolutely put in a get-home bag, an EDC bag, especially considering what's going on in the world today? And what is really the purpose and what are we trying to accomplish with this thing? Because it's maybe more than you might think we're going to say. Until next time, stay aware, stay safe, and train hard. You've been listening to The Arms Room.